ladies and gentlemen. I'm Alfred Adisk, and this is Financial Survival. It's our Thursday, our Wednesday night program for Wednesday, second day of August, year of our Lord 2017. James Corbett will be joining us after the first break. James will be calling in from Japan, and James publishes one of the most articulate, intelligent, knowledgeable individuals you can find on the internet right now. It's always a pleasure. I always enjoy talking to James. Before we get to James, we'll do the market report, a couple of other commentaries, and James should be here a little after, about 23 after. First off, gold is down $2 today to $1,267.20 per ounce. Silver was off 13 cents, $16.66 per ounce. Platinum was up $2 to $9.50. Palladium was flat, didn't go up or down, $8.94. We'll look at the crude oil. Is down, was down 12 cents to $49.47 per barrel. The U.S. dollar index was down earlier today. I don't have the number for the during the day right now. It's up a dime, 92.97, and I think the U.S. dollar index is perhaps, I think that's the main story right now. It has been declining. It's declined by at least 9% since the first of the year. And not many people have picked up on this and paid attention to it until just the last week or so. The dollar has dropped significantly on the U.S. dollar index. I believe it was 103 thereabouts. Now it's down below 93. The big question is, will the dollar fall below 90 on the U.S. dollar index? If they allow the dollar to fall below 90, I think it's going to be good evidence that they really want inflation in this country. They're going to let it break loose. And the price of gold is in theory going to rise. But the dollar index falling as much as it has, over 9% since the first of the year, you know, in theory, if it kept on at that rate, we could be down 12-14% by the end of the year. This is the big story right now. Dow Jones, of course, set another record high today, over 22,000. It was at 22,016. NASDAQ is down 0.29, next to nothing, at 6,362. New York Stock Exchange down 20 points to 11,979. Standard & Poor 500 up one, just a little over a point, 2,477. The big news, I think, is the U.S. dollar index and its steady decline for the first 7 months of this year. And we'll watch and see if anyone is going to stop that from happening or not, if they're going to allow it to continue. And the reason they will allow it to continue, the reason I believe they want inflation, is because inflation allows the government to pay off its debt with cheaper dollars. Deflation will destroy the government because the government is the biggest debtor in the world, and deflation forces any debtor to pay off its debt with more expensive dollars. Right? The real size of the national debt during a period of deflation grows. The number stays the same, still be $20 trillion. The number doesn't grow, but the value of each one of the dollars increases, and the result is that the net burden of the debt actually is, it grows during a period of deflation. During a period of inflation, when the dollar is becoming less valuable, again, the national debt stays the same, it's still $20 trillion. But the inflation causes each of those $20 trillion to be worth less and less. And as they are worth less, it becomes easier to pay off the debt. You get to pay off the debt in cheaper dollars. I believe that the government is so badly indebted, so unsustainably indebted, that they're going to do anything they can to try to hold this system together. And I think one of the things they have to do is repudiate the debt. And they can repudiate the debt There are only two ways I think you can repudiate the debt. One is overtly come out and just say, sorry, folks, we're broken, we can't pay the debt. And that's been true for a long time. That's not a projection into the future. Say, gee, the government might someday, I know it's hard to imagine, the government might someday be overly indebted and unable to pay the debt. That's been true technically since at least 1971 when we went off the gold standard. It used to be we paid our debts, at least at the international level, with gold. Since 1971, we have not openly done that. There's some debate whether or not we have any gold left at Fort Knox or wherever in the U.S. Treasury. There's some concern about that, but I don't know what the truth is, and I don't know who does. But at least up until 1971, we actually paid our debt with gold, foreign-held debt. Since 1971, when Nixon closed the gold window, we have technically not paid any of our debts. And when I say we, I really mean the government. I'm not speaking about you and me per se, although the same thing is true for us. When you really begin to understand the nature of currency, the nature of money, you begin to understand that you can't pay a debt with a debt instrument. You can discharge a debt, but you can't pay a debt with anything other than gold or perhaps silver. We're not paying our debts. And I know a lot of people, if they hear me saying that right now, they think that's just crazy. Of course we're paying our debts. No, really not. All right, and I don't have time. I won't get into it right now. It's a long story, and I'm not going to get into it at this time. But we haven't paid our debts since 1971 when we stopped paying in gold, redeeming paper dollars and digital dollars in gold. All right. Now, the point of that is we have been indebted, we have been insolvent, not just indebted, insolvent since 1971. That's 29, 39, 46 years. We haven't actually been paying our bills. We've been discharging them with more debt instruments, but we have not been paying our bills with gold. So here we sit, and the government is still having a problem, even though it's been able to get by with just discharging the debt with paper currency. The government is caught. It's gone so deeply into even an apparent debt denominated in paper currency that even that can't be paid anymore. It's like we've reached a point where it's not only true that we can't pay our debt with gold and silver coin. It's true that we can't pay our debt with monopoly money, right? We have reached a point, and in order to, if this continues and it becomes undeniable that we can't pay our debt, well, the whole system is going to collapse. The whole thing is based on public confidence, not just in the United States, but in the world, public confidence in the fiat dollar. And what is that confidence about? We are confident that the dollar can pay our bills. It can pay our debts. The problem government has is that it's so deeply indebted that it can't. It can't pay its debts. There's no way the government can pay $20 trillion. I believe that works out to $20 trillion current national debt that they admit to, the official national debt. And the real national debt, according to some sources, could be over $200 trillion. It could be 10 times greater than what they admit to. But operating based just the official national debt, $20 trillion. That works out to over $60,000 for every man, woman, and child in the country. It's over $250,000 for every family of four. How many families of four do you know that have an extra $250,000 or even $250,000 that they would be willing to send to the government to help pay off the debt? I don't know any. You know, I don't know that many who have $250,000 in assets. They may be living in a $500,000 home, but they don't own it yet. Their equity in the home may be $100,000. And I don't know what their equity in their car is, but the point is, not many people have $250,000 in real equity. Where are they going to get the money to pay the national debt? They can't just raise taxes. We don't have enough money to pay it. They can't. If they raise the taxes enough to pay off the national debt, you and I would be living in austerity. It would be the same thing that they've done with Greece, pretty much. Right? Reduce benefits and increase taxes. Austerity. Net result is austerity. We are in such deep trouble right now financially that the government cannot tolerate any more debt. And as a result, I think this is why the U.S. dollar index, this may be why the U.S. dollar index has fallen 9% so far this year. Technically, it means that the size of the national debt has actually declined by 9%. The number is still the same, still $20 trillion. But because the dollars are worth 9% less, the debt has been diminished by 9%. Technically, you could make the argument that the national debt is now, instead of $20 trillion as it was at the beginning of the year, technically it's down a little over $18 trillion. Now, they can't say that to us. They can't explain that to us. But the point remains, the government has to get out from under this debt. And there's only two ways to do it. One is overt repudiation, where we just say, look, folks, we're broke, we can't pay, sorry about that. Or, two, they can do it stealthily by imposing inflation. And inflation, and particularly hyperinflation, will trash the debt. So my point is that the government needs inflation to deal with the debt, to diminish the debt. I'm not saying they will only use inflation to diminish the debt. In some regards, they may still overtly repudiate the debt. But inflation, they don't have to admit, we're broke. And I think the government has an incentive to do it, and therefore the government will do it. And I'm not surprised. I'm not surprised that the dollar index has fallen below 93. I will be surprised. I won't be shocked. But I will be surprised if they allow it to fall below 90 on the U.S. dollar index. If they do, it'll be a sign that, better get ready for some serious inflation in this country. We'll watch and we will see. What else do we have here? Here's something, an article from Bloomberg. The headline is, States Turn to Financial Engineering to Ease Pension Burdens. And what do they mean by financial engineering? They mean cooking the books. They mean engaging in fraud. They mean committing crimes in order to maintain the illusion that the pensions can be paid. Truth is, our total debt is too large to ever be repaid in full, and pensions are merely one part of that debt. I know that some people are going to get their pensions, but a lot of people are not. Pensions that people counted for, particularly government agency pensions and the rest of that, and people thought, I'm going to be able to retire and I'll be rich and the rest of that. Well, maybe you'll be able to retire, maybe. But you're not going to be as rich as you had hoped to be if you are a retired government employee. Before this is done, either by means of inflation or by means of outward repudiation, the people who have government pensions are going to see their hoped-for retirement standard of living diminished drastically. So in any case, states turn to financial engineering to ease pension burdens. It's no secret that states and cities across the country are grappling with a growing pension crisis. Now some are resorting to an unconventional tool to help. Financial engineering. Okay, an unconventional tool. That's like using bank robbery to solve your credit card problems. All right, getting a little trouble paying off your Visa card? Well, if you hold up the bank, that's an unconventional tool. It's a kind of financial engineering, all right? What it is a criminal act, of course. California, New Jersey, and other governments are moving resources around on their balance sheets to lessen the burden of their underfunded pensions as more traditional reforms, that is to say legal reforms, like increasing the burden on the people who are going to retire or cutting their benefits, as these traditional reforms have failed to fix the ailing system. Strategies have included everything from transferring lottery money to public pensions to recognizing future revenues to lower current funding ratios. And I think when they say recognizing future revenues, I think they're talking about how much money do you expect to make it next year or the year from now, or 2 years from now or 5 years from now, and somehow counting that today as income that can pay off this pension, the pensions. And it's just a contrivance. It's another one of, they're going into the appearance of reality. They're trying to create the appearance that they are on a steadier footing. The pensions are on a steadier footing, and they're not. They're going to have a problem, and it's not going to be resolved by financial engineering. It will be postponed. They can kick the can down the road a little further. They can postpone the inevitable for another couple of years. But the fact is, sooner or later, they're going to have to admit a fundamental fact. We don't have the money to pay the pensions. Right? They haven't been properly funded. They are unfunded liabilities, and what do they mean when they talk about unfunded liabilities? What is an unfunded liability? You hear people talk about it in the government. The national debt, depending on how it's calculated, sometimes they include unfunded liabilities, sometimes they don't. What is an unfunded liability? It is a mere promise. It's a situation where government has promised, we're going to pay you $10,000 a month. As a retired government employee, you're going to get $10,000 a month. If it's an unfunded liability, it has no money to back up that promise. It is a mere promise. It is unfunded. Nobody put money away to back up that promise. And you have to, we live in a world where there are so many promises, so many debts, they can't all be kept. And sooner or later, they're going to have to cancel many of their unfunded liabilities. They're going to have to admit they can't keep their promises. They don't want to do it, of course, but they're going to have to do it before this is all over. California, well, we're going to run out of time here before we can get into this much deeper, but financial, the fact that they're engaged in financial engineering, or what they call financial engineering, this is like quantitative easing. You know, it was more smoke and mirrors. It's pumping sunshine. It's creating an illusion. It's struggling to maintain confidence where there's no grounds for confidence. You have to ask yourself, why are they maintaining an illusion? And the answer is because reality is so terrifying, at least to some people, that they don't want to expose it to the public. They know that reality will discourage our confidence in the system, in the monetary system, in the government, in the Federal Reserve. They can't give us reality. They have to give us illusions. That's evidence that we are in deep, deep trouble. We're going to take a break for a couple of commercials, and James Corbett should be joining us from Japan in just a moment. Please stay tuned to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interest of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSETalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at DGScoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Addison. This is Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver at 1-800-375-4188. For all your gold and silver coin needs, our guest is James Corbett from the Corbett Report, C-O-R-B-E-T-T, report.com. James has, again, say it every week, but or every 2 weeks when James is on the program, certainly one of the most prolific pundits. Can I call you a pundit, James?
I guess I won't object to the term.
You would object?
I guess I won't object.
Okay, won't object. Okay.
Only because I don't think I have a better word. I don't know what word to use.
Yeah, I know. I don't want to say guru. Don't want to say pundit. I don't know, commentator. All of them apply to me to greater or lesser extent. And no one calls me the wise old man on the mountain. They might call me a pundit, but nobody says, oh, go see the wise guru. No, they don't get that. So I don't know. But in any case, really, you are constantly pumping out videos, podcasts, written articles, and you are prolific. I've got an article here from Foundation for Economic Education, and the headline is Why the SEC is Terrified of Cryptocurrency. And it says the federal government is no match for innovation. This is something lawmakers have always known, and it's the reason why state and federal regulations exist. But innovation by its very nature will always find a way around those regulations, resulting in implementation of more regulation for creative minds to learn to evade, which they will. The result is the overregulation we see in America today. Nothing scares government more than something it can't control, and the SEC and the Securities and Exchange Commission revealed this week that it's terrified of cryptocurrencies as well as it should be. Do you think the SEC has a real cause? Is it hyper? Are we exaggerating when we say that the SEC is terrified by cryptocurrencies? They have reason to be afraid, or is this something that they'll deal with?
Well, I think they have reason to be afraid of the idea. I don't think they have reason to be afraid of much of the implementation of that idea so far, at least not the way that a lot of people are using the technology. But the idea of the technology itself obviously should be quite frightening to all of the would-be central planners who want to micromanage every single aspect of the economy, because this technology that has been enabled now and is available really is the complete decentralization and disintermediation of the financial system as it has existed. And people are starting to get an inkling of an idea as to what that could potentially mean in terms of different ways of not just transacting, although that is obviously one part of it. A cash for the internet is something. I mean, that's an idea, but it's much deeper than that, because it brings forth different ideas about ways of organizing society itself, which are fundamentally anemic to the would-be tyrants. For example, I mean, you may have heard of Ethereum, yep, which is a different type of cryptocurrency, but it's not really a currency. It's a platform which enables smart contracts, which is an idea basically to, again, disintermediate centralized systems that require third parties to arbitrate various transactions or things, escrow and things like that. Well, in this case, you can have a smart contract whereby something is fulfilled and is approved as having been fulfilled, certain conditions are met, and something else will automatically occur, and this is all kept on the decentralized, open, permissionless public infrastructure of a blockchain. What does that actually mean? I mean, that just sounds like a lot of language, but for people who are thinking about how to apply this to societal problems, you come up with ideas like, for example, there's a fascinating idea that I've only recently heard about because I haven't been following it closely yet, but I'm certainly going to be, an idea like Swarm City. Swarm City has its own token running on the Ethereum blockchain, but the idea behind Swarm City is that eventually you're going to have people who will be able to, for example, follow a hashtag based on their regional location. And on this hashtag, basically, you will be there will be a smart contract in place so that if and when you need a service, like, I don't know, it could be firefighting, or it could be anything else, police services or what have you, emergency rescue services, the contract will kick into place so that the rescuers will be paid automatically from your account through this Swarm City. And what this does is it completely it gives rise to the idea that we do not need a government to come and forcibly collect taxes from everyone in order to provide all of these functions that we're told only government could possibly provide. It is actually enabling the realization of the idea of decentralization in everything, including these government services. And there's a lot of, I mean, there's so many of these ideas that are coming online right now that are enabled by these technologies, which is why the SEC, at any rate, as well as I imagine a lot of other government institutions, should be afraid of the idea of this technology. It's just that so few people are actually aware of these implementations that are possible with this new technology, or starting to think of the different ways that this can be applied.
There's a war on cash going on around the world. Do you think that the central banks can continue to wage that war in a world where cryptocurrencies exist? Do they have to balance out the probability that if they eliminate the cash, will it force everyone to be under government control? And I think that's their primary reason for eliminating the cash. They want to tax every transaction. They're afraid they're missing some of the money we're spending, or what they regard as their share. I think their reason for eliminating cash is to force everyone to be taxed every time we spend a nickel or a dime. If they can implement a cashless society, does that increase the likelihood that people will go over to cryptocurrencies? And is government afraid of that, or do they think they can control it?
Well, I think they can control it, and they're having some degree of success with that already, just by putting in the regulatory framework that surrounds the exchanges that are the kind of the gatekeepers into and out of the cryptocurrency space. If you want to buy cryptocurrency, if you want to sell it, you have to go through one of these exchanges, and they are heavily regulated now with all the know your customer types of regulations that act as the gatekeeping device that governments use to regulate that market. So they are finding ways to do that. Of course, that doesn't prevent people from using it in the way that you would use cash or something. I mean, there, for any cash transaction, you're supposed to note it down and have a receipt and submit that to the government when it comes time for them to collect their thefts every year. Doesn't mean that everyone does it. And in the same way, you can run your own wallet and transact directly with other people, and the government will never be able to know that, other than to see that this string of letters sent this amount of Bitcoin to this other string of letters, and unless they have your personal identity associated with that, they have no way of really doing anything with that information. So I mean, it's again, the idea, theoretically it could be used for those purposes, and that's why cryptocurrency can and presumably will be used by a growing percentage of people who are aware of this technology and how to use it, but that's still only a tiny fraction of people out there. And most people, I mean, are not going to adapt something where they have to know about all of these obscure parts of how to secure their accounts and run their own wallet and do all of these things themselves. I mean, most people just want some sort of app that they magically touch their phone to some screen and, you know, it just happens and they never have to think about it. But of course, that convenience only ever comes with giving up control to some centralizing body like a financial institution or a government. So I think there are, I mean, there's two different senses of the future cashless society. One is the cashless society of essentially, you know, government-controlled fiat currency of some sort being the central part of that cashless society and government monitors everywhere and looking at everything that goes on. Or there's the idea of a cashless system in which they're just strings of letters and numbers floating around the net, and there's no way to track or control that. And obviously, those give rise to very different usage cases and different visions of the future. So obviously, the cashless society they want to bring in, the would-be controllers, are ones that they can control completely. And I think that's obviously the direction we've seen things trending in recent years.
Well, when we talk about them controlling it completely, people in power being able to control this cashless society completely, they mean that the people have no control. They get to control, we don't have any control. And the cryptocurrencies are actually saying, well, maybe we could have control and the government wouldn't have any. The whole idea behind centralization means control. If you have a centralized system, there's somebody sitting in the center who can say yes, no, or maybe to virtually every question that comes in. And centralization is essential to control. I think you already know this. I'm sure. I assume you do. You must have heard this. But the internet was started as a means to communicate between basically the military-industrial complex, manufacturers, people who manufactured defense products, the government, and it was implemented by computers the size of the room you're sitting in right now. They did not anticipate the day would ever come that the great unwashed, that would be you and me, would have computers that fit in the palm of your hand, right, that can access that internet. And because they didn't anticipate the growth of technology, the internet was not centralized. It was not easily subject to centralized control. And that has caused a great burden on government. They don't like that, but they haven't, as yet, haven't been able to do anything completely effective to kind of grab hold of the internet and say, they're trying, but they haven't been able to do that. Well, what I'm getting to is the internet was perhaps the first decentralized revolution we've had in this country in a long time, if not forever. And blockchain, cryptocurrency is another wave from that, perhaps the same revolution or the same idea. We're headed towards decentralization. Do you think that we will be allowed to live in a decentralized world? Do you think the system will stop it with force if necessary, or do they have to learn to get along with it?
I can't obviously say definitively, but I can say what my intuition is. And my intuition is that the technology drives the societal conversation, but also the practices that happen around that technology. So that a new technology comes about, and it basically forces its own way into the world. And obviously the would-be controllers try to control that in various ways, but I think you can only keep that lid on the bottle to a certain extent. So one example that I think most people can see and have seen over the last few years is in the Uber/Lyft realm, where, you know, a decade or two decades ago, of course, taxis are the way that you get around. I mean, people had just internalized that. The idea of something like a decentralized taxi service, just what does that even mean? How could we even possibly envision that? Well, now We have that. And all that was the technological ability and the fact that everyone's walking around with these phones in their pocket and are connected to the internet and can connect with each other in networks. Well, suddenly we have the ability with all this, you know, available space in people's cars. Well, other people can contract to use some of that available space. Now, as always, I always have to add the caveat in here that I don't think Uber and Lyft and these things that we've seen are the ideals. These are ultimately just corporations that are trying to make use of this technology and have their own things inside of them. But the idea itself, the idea of decentralization, so that people can peer-to-peer directly connect with each other for and contract with each other for various services that previously they would have needed a middleman of some sort, and generally these taxi cabs are operating on monopoly medallions that they have to buy from city governments, and it's all been a nice lucrative top trough for a lot of people to feed from. Well, people can now get rid of that trough and communicate directly. That, again, that's the idea that comes along. It's the revolutionary technological idea that's combined with the actual implementation. And it starts to change the way people perceive the world and the way that things have to be. So that, yes, of course, we see governments trying to fight back now against Uber and Lyft and these types of things and try to bring in regulations. But people have already experienced this. They've already seen, oh, you know, this is so much easier.
This
so much,
works.
This works.
This can work. This
and
is
we
possible.
Can do this. Yeah. And so now it's a lot harder for them to put that cap back on it. Now, they'll probably, again, try to steer this into some sort of thing where we'll allow this company to do it, but we won't allow some, you know, random upstart to do it on a truly decentralized network. Because, you know, again, for all the usual reasons, but ultimately because of control. But again, it's the idea. And I like to think that these technologies that come along start to shape people's perception of the world in general. It works on an almost subconscious level.
And yeah, if you can do it with Uber, what else can you do it with?
Exactly.
Can we do it with plumbing repair, with heating and air conditioning? Can we just call somebody who maybe isn't licensed, but nevertheless, is it possible to set up a system where you can get tradesmen coming to your home based on
someone cut
a decentralized
your hair without a license?
Yeah, the whole thing is it's phenomenal. I mean, it's really revolutionary. It's an extraordinary system. I'm curious whether you think Uber, we've only got about a minute left before we take our break, but could Uber have succeeded if the economy was not in trouble? And what I mean by that is if we'd set up the Uber system and said, I can take my car and I can go make some money driving people around and I can be effective, something like a taxi driver. Would I have taken that opportunity if the economy was not in trouble? If I'd been making good money, would I have said, okay, this is a great idea, and I want to get into it, or would I have said, no, I don't need that?
If everyone was driving around in their own personal limos and smoking $100 bills and things, yeah, one could imagine there wouldn't be much of a service, a supply side of it, because there wouldn't be a lot of people who'd be willing to do that as for a living. So I suppose that's one aspect of it. But I think the idea itself still would have come about, if for no other reason than, like every other monopoly, it starts to get out of control and prices rise almost exponentially. In the 10 years from 2001 to 2011, the price of a New York City taxi cab medallion rose 6,000%.
It's almost as good as Bitcoin.
Yeah.
Maybe it was anticipated Bitcoin, perhaps. We're going to take a break for a couple of commercials. I'll be back with James Corbett from the CorbettReport.com in just a moment. Please stay tuned. Oh,
food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com, or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
We all know that Berkey Water Purification Systems are the most trusted name in water filtration. As an authorized Berkey dealer for over 6 years and serving thousands of satisfied customers, the Berkey Guy offers amazing specials for Berkey Water Filtration Systems. The Berkey Light Systems include a set of self-sterilizing and recleanable black purification elements that purify water by removing chlorine, pathogenic bacteria, cysts, and parasites to non-detectable levels and remove harmful chemicals such as herbicides and pesticides. Order the Berkey Light System today, complete with two black Berkey elements for only $231, and the Berkey Guy will ship your order free of charge. With the purchase of a Berkey Light, the Berkey Guy is also offering a set of fluoride and arsenic filters for only $39.99. That's over 30% off the retail price. Call the Berkey Guy at 1-877-886-3653. That's 1-877-886-3653. Or order online at GoBerkey.com. That's GoBerkey.com today.
Hi, folks, I'm Alfred Addisk, and this is Financial Survival. My guest is James Corbett from thecorbettreport.com, and we've been talking about cryptocurrencies and the technology behind them. Now, they really do seem, in many regards, to be an idea whose time has come. At the same time, I've got a headline right here: hackers steal staggering $32 million in Ethereum. Got another headline: former Bitcoin exchange Cripsy CEO ordered to pay $8.2 million in class action lawsuit. U.S. hacker taken for stealing necklace confesses to a $40 million Bitcoin heist. This guy's got to be crazy. He's stolen $40 million, but he's also stealing somebody's necklace. And that's how he got caught on this thing. Another one. Here's Parity hack. White Hat Group drains $85 million as company fills holes. And what this is, apparently it was Ethereum. I don't have the... I've got the article in front of me.
Yeah, it was Ethereum.
They were threatened. They were in danger of being... of having more money stolen from them, or more cryptocurrency stolen from them. And somebody, some group of good guys, good hackers, as opposed to the evil hackers, they jumped in and they stole $85 million. But they didn't steal it to keep it. They stole it just to get it out of harm's way. But they apparently did this in a matter of just a few hours. They said, hey, Ethereum's in trouble. Let's go in there and steal their money, and we'll put it over in a box where we can keep it safe, because they can't. It implies that somebody who knows what they're doing can crack into Ethereum in half a day. My point in all of this is this idea whose time has come, if that's what it is it going to be able to survive the ease with which hackers are able to liberate people's funds?
Well, ultimately, yes. And that's precisely because these attacks, every time they are implemented and every time the thieves get away with stealing however much money, obviously then the wallets are upgraded, or the vulnerabilities are patched, and it becomes stronger. So it's like any iterative system. It continues to get more and more secure as these things happen. Now, of course, in the meantime, that's certainly not consolation to anyone who has had money stolen from their cryptocurrency accounts because of these vulnerabilities. I think this says a couple of things. First of all, it says that what we have right now is the perfect storm for problems like this, because you have this rapidly expanding sector of the economy. Its market cap went from a couple of billion dollars a few years ago to $50 billion today, and it's expanding at that kind of rate, and that there seems to be no slowdown in that expansion. So suddenly there's all this money, and there, you have all these newly minted cryptocurrency millionaires and even billionaires and whatever who were, had just invested a few thousand dollars and now find themselves beneficiaries of millions, or at least millions of zeros, whatever that means, ones and zeros. But with that, especially with something that's highly technologically advanced and new, and there's still a lot of people kind of wrapping their heads around this, so they're not able to secure their wallets in the right way, you know, this is just the perfect storm. And so obviously criminals are being drawn into this right now to, because they know there's a lot of red meat sitting out there for the taking. The other part of this story, though, is the quite a remarkable thing, the white hats stepping in and stealing the money in order to save it, basically, which is a remarkable thing, but really shouldn't be that remarkable, because of course we have to keep in mind that most people, most of the time, in most situations, are not looking to slit, you know, their neighbor's throat and drink the blood and, you know, do anything to get ahead kind of thing. Most people, most of the time, in most ordinary circumstances, do care about their neighbors and do care about each other, even if only for the selfish reason that they know that this future long-term stability of these cryptocurrencies is dependent on them actually having a sustainable and viable environment where people actually do look out for each other. So even if it's just the self-motivation, it's still there, and we still function as a community. And this is a good example of that. And so it does show some of the best of human nature and some of the worst in the exact same story.
Well, it certainly shows vulnerabilities. And although in this one instance where the good guys stole the money to hide it from the bad guys, it's still evidence. If you know what you're doing, you can crack into these things without much trouble. And we're talking about $32 million, $85 million in cryptocurrencies. How many high school kids can resist that?
Right. Well, I mean, a couple of
things. How many felony flyers can you buy for $82 million?
Yeah. Well, it wasn't, I wouldn't say it was done without much work. I mean, obviously it was hackers who knew exactly what they were doing, but secondly, it was only one type of wallet, from what I understand, that was not properly secured. So again, it's kind of like if someone breaks into a bank and steals money from the, you know, Bank of America or something like that, then saying that the dollar is, you know, well, who can trust the dollar? People can steal this from banks. I mean, again, we tend to think of these things kind of just this giant monolithic new thing that has come along without understanding the specifics of it. So when someone breaks into a certain type of wallet on a certain type of cryptocurrency platform, people think, oh, cryptocurrencies are all invalid.
Well, I don't know that again, they're invalid, but they do appear to be vulnerable.
Well, there are vulnerabilities,
and
people should
it,
be, you know, concerned about that.
When you deal with hackers, how do we secure the Internet in general, not just cryptocurrencies, but the Internet in general? Can it really be secured against hackers as long as it's made to be convenient for millions and even billions of people? I mean, if everybody can get on the Internet, how do you also make sure that the hackers can't get on the Internet, or the thieves can't get on the Internet, or they're easily traced? The fact that it's so convenient is evidence to me that the doors are open for people to come in and rob people.
Right. And if everyone can fly an airplane, then, you know, terrorists can fly airplanes.
Oh, yeah.
So we better crack down on that. And if everyone can get on a bus, then terrorists can get on a bus with a bomb. So we should probably have guards and scanners and police dogs at every bus and frisking people down. And people can hide things in backpacks on the street. So every time you see someone with a backpack, you should open it up and take a look at what's inside. I mean, we should have a total police state. Yeah.
You could just shoot them on sight and save a bunch of muss and fuss.
Exactly. Well, that's the logic of the situation. And I understand people do see this as some sort of trade-off. Well, we have to give up a little bit of liberty to get security. And I understand that conversation, how it takes place. I certainly obviously fall down quite strongly on the other end of that scale, but I understand why people believe that and why they argue for it. But that is the ultimate where that kind of logic heads. And the point is, yeah, if we do have an internet where anyone can log in, yeah, there's going to be criminals that log in and do things like that. So what exactly is the alternative? Should we all be fingerprinting and eye scanning to get on the internet? Because, I mean, we may laugh, but that really is in the future. And they've been talking about it, and there's been a lot of stories about it, and the government has been trial ballooning these types of things for government agents to get on their own networks and things. You have to have special vetted IDs, and they're looking at how this can ultimately be sold to the public. And that's what I worry about.
One of the things that I'm curious about is that Bitcoin and the cryptocurrencies are not the only innovation that we're talking about. We're talking about blockchain also, and Bitcoin and the cryptocurrencies are a function of blockchain, the way I understand it. But I have no doubt that blockchain, everything I see, is going to be have a massive impact across the world on smart contracts, for example. And, I don't know, following debt, the trail of debt from one person to another and investments and one, there's a great advantage in blockchain, and I'd bet that the government likes blockchain. But what about is the strength of the blockchain technology, is it separate from the strength of Bitcoin? Bitcoin relies on blockchain, but it's not the same thing. If something were to separate blockchain from cryptocurrencies, do cryptocurrencies still have strength on their own, or are these two different phenomena that are confused right now, but they are really separate phenomena?
Yeah. Well, they are separate phenomena, and I'm trying to think of the right analogy, the right way to analogize this situation so that it makes some more sense. So I reserve the right to go back on this analogy if it doesn't quite work out, but it's something like saying the difference between the U.S. dollar as an entity, as a thing, versus the technology of printing something on paper. I mean, that's what we're looking at. The U.S. dollar is this... yes, I mean, it's something that's printed on paper, but it's so much more than that. It's embedded in all the system, and it has this value to it that's put in there by a system that's in place that has these rules and laws. And so that's something to give at least maybe a way into the conversation. The blockchain technology, as you say, is a technology. It's an open ledger, distributed. It's permissionless. It's trustless. It's public and completely available to every part of everything that's on the node of that network. That's what a blockchain ledger is. And of course, on top of that, you can build something like Bitcoin. But it's kind of like saying with a printer, you can print money. Well, kind of, yeah, but there's a lot of other things that go into, a lot of other things that come out of printers and a lot of other things that go into printing a money that other people use. So it's kind of more complicated than that.
Well, that's a decent analogy. But the main point from my perspective is blockchain can survive without Bitcoin from the way I look at it. But I don't think Bitcoin can survive without blockchain, and I'm not sure. You know, I think blockchain, yeah, I think that's going to be here. You know, if I live another 100 years, we're going to have blockchain. Will we still have cryptocurrencies? I think that's perhaps debatable. But while we have maybe 3-4 minutes left on the program, why don't you talk to us a little about Korea? You're close by. What's happening there? What's likely to happen? Where are we going in about 3-4 minutes?
Well, so much of this depends ultimately on the U.S. and on China, which is kind of ironic, but, I mean, that's the situation we're in. And I think that this is more, again, about global geopolitics and great power conflict than it is solely about what's happening in Pyongyang. And so, ultimately, I don't think this is decidable from any any sort of perspective of, you know, what is Pyongyang calculating or what will Seoul try to get with Pyongyang. This ultimately comes down to, is the U.S. going to try to do some sort of military thing, or, you know, can they convince China to do some sort of sanctions or something along those lines? And then it just enters the realm of diplomacy and politics and all of that. So I don't think that's really – I mean, there's no way of predicting exactly how that's going to play out, especially with a Trump administration that contradicts itself in every possible way every second of the day. So the latest apparently is that Tillerson has Secretary of State Rex Tillerson has made some sort of claim about, we're willing to negotiate, but you have to be willing to disarm or something along those lines, which of course is completely different than UN Ambassador Nikki Haley, who's been saying the time for negotiation is over, which is completely different from Trump himself, who's tweeting about China and what they should be doing. So even less so than usual is there any way to accurately predict what's coming here. But I think ultimately this does come down to those types of politics more so than anything that's happening in North Korea itself.
It seems like some of the sides are so intransigent that the only way this is likely to be resolved is militarily. Can anyone really compromise? They say, well, we're willing to negotiate if you're willing to disarm. Well, that's telling people right up front, here's the deal, you got to disarm. And if you don't, we're going to bomb you. If we're going to negotiate, you would think it leaves all options open, and we'll talk about it. They're saying, we'll talk about everything provided that you disarm.
Right.
Will North Korea do that?
Probably not, and especially not given the history of the situation and the fact that there was an agreed framework to start some sort of negotiation process in 1994 that was pursued to some extent during the Clinton administration. But when Bush and the neocons came in, they deliberately set about sabotaging that and happened in adding North Korea to the axis of evil and all of that. And that's when we saw North Korea starting their nuclear weapons program. So I think there's just so much history that goes into this. And, you know, at this point, who's going to believe who? I mean, even if there was some sort of seriously offered thing on the table, we'll do this if you do that, I don't think either side's going to trust the other at this point.
That's
kind of the sticking point of the entire negotiation.
We have a Hatfield versus McCoy situation here, where I doubt if anyone can remember what the original offense was.
Yeah.
That's a little bit of an exaggeration. I'm sure they remember the Korean War and whatever,
right.
But just the same.
Well, exactly. Just as a parting thought here, just go back to 1957, which is when the U.S. started the North Korean nuclear issue as a crisis by introducing nuclear weapons to the peninsula in direct violation of the armistice agreement. That's when the nuclear crisis really happened.
Well, and so trying to point the finger at the bad guy is hard to do without pointing at ourselves, perhaps. But we're going to have to let that subject go to another day because we're out of time. I want to thank you for being on the program, James. Always a pleasure. Always interesting. James Corbett from CorbettReport.com. I'm Alfred Addis. This is Financial Survival. We'll be back tomorrow. In the meantime, with good Lord bless you, me, Melody, Todd, the producer, and James Corbett.
I work all night, I work all day to pay the bills I have to pay. Ain't it sad? And still there never seems to be a single penny left for me. That's too bad.